Welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, Jerry Roll of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky.
We are a foundation that is based in Eastern Kentucky, for Eastern Kentucky. We're with Eastern Kentucky.
Laura Smith of the Appalachian Impact Fund.
We are the first and only place-based impact investment fund focused on Eastern Kentucky.
Annie Rouse on the growing pains of a burgeoning new Kentucky hemp industry.
There's still a lot we don't know about cannabinoids and how they're interacting with certain medications and things in that regard that really need to be more fully vetted.
And Kentucky maple syrup.
What if we did it today as an economic piece, as an economic driver?
First this hour, the Ohio River is a drinking water source for about 5 million people. It's also a heavily industrialized river. The federal government has been rolling back protections from pollution generated by industries along the Ohio. But recently, a commission that represents Kentucky and 7 other states along the river and its 9 tributaries voted to maintain its authority to set regional water pollution standards rather than giving up that power to each individual state. James Bruggers has been following this story, and after more than 18 years covering energy and the environment for the Courier-Journal, Jim is now a writer for Inside Climate News, and he joins us from member station WFPL in Louisville. Greetings, Jim.
Why, thank you. Good to be here.
And if you would first bring us up to speed, what was the proposal before the Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission, or SANCO, as we're going to refer to it going forward?
The proposal that's before them now is pretty similar to what the current situation is, with maybe a little caveat. Our SANCO, this commission, would retain the authority to be able to establish water quality standards for this 981-mile-long river and the industries along it. But it would give states the ability to, if they don't want to follow them, to propose something that's an alternative, and then that alternative would be reviewed in the course of whenever the states would be issuing permits for the industries. And then Orsenko would look at those permits and see whether they were generally consistent with what Orsenko standards are and whether they would make sure that the river would maintain its designated uses, such as recreation, swimming, fishing, drinking water, that sort of thing.
So this commission has a pretty long history of setting water standards for hazardous chemicals and heavy metals from coal burning and other industries, often at tougher levels than state or federal standards. Do these standards, these Orsenko standards, have teeth? Are they enforceable?
Orsenko itself doesn't have an enforcement arm, but the states do, and the states are members of a compact. And for those states that have adopted the Orsenko standards, and not all of them have, which is something that I guess has come out through this process, a recognition that not all the states are following all the different water quality standards, and there's many of them. But it's the states that actually do the enforcement. So what you have with Orsenko and a regional commission like this is you've got an agency or a body that then gets all these states together to come up with kind of a shared vision of what water quality looks like. And then it's up to the states then to enforce that vision.
So let's talk about what's going into the river from industries along the Ohio's banks, along the banks of its tributaries. What kinds of pollutants can be found in the wastewater coming from these plants?
Well, there's sewage from sewage treatment plants. And, of course, a lot of that sewage most of the time is being treated, but there's still some residuals that can be in that that can cause some potential harm. And then there's also industries. You know, there's still some steel industry. There's still a number of coal-fired power plants. And there's other manufacturing plants, and they can discharge heavy metals and other kinds of pollutants. In fact, it's really interesting. Sort of the granddaddy of all federal government pollution databases is the Toxics Release Inventory. And the EPA requires industries to self-report the pollution that they emit, either land, air, water. And the Ohio River in recent years, as recently as I think 2015, received the most industrial pollution than any other river in the country. So it is a significant working river at this point. Now, there's all kinds of other pollution. You know, there's a lot of stormwater runoff, and there's pollution from farms. And so other rivers could be more polluted. But in terms of industrial pollution, the Ohio River has long kind of carried a pretty significant burden.
Okay, getting back to the matter before the commission, before Arsenko, if you would describe the battle lines for us. Who has been rooting for the commission sticking to its guns and maintaining these standards, and who has been pressing to get rid of them?
The battle lines are pretty clearly drawn. It's the general public and drinking water utilities have not wanted Arsenko to give up its authority to set regional water quality standards, whereas the heavy industries, the electric utilities, they've generally wanted the Arsenko to, you know, no longer set those standards and focus more on research and monitoring water quality in the Ohio River. They argue that the Arsenko standards duplicate state standards, duplicate federal standards. Arsenko was created in like 1948, was well before the establishment of the EPA in 1970 and before the passage of the Clean Water Act in 72. So there are, in the Clean Water Act, the EPA does have guidance for how states are supposed to regulate water pollution. So there is, you know, that's their argument that there's duplication. But what the drinking water utilities and the general public and environmental groups have been saying is that there's times when you may want to have a rule that exceeds a federal guideline because there might be a particular situation in the river that needs to be addressed.
And I guess they might argue that more forcefully now that the EPA is actually rolling back some of these standards.
Yeah, that's definitely a point that environmental groups, as well as a fairly prominent commissioner, environmental attorney, Tom Fitzgerald, was arguing, was that these standards are needed because you never know exactly which direction the federal government's going to go. And so this is a way to strike some sort of regional consensus among the member states in terms of maintaining the Ohio River water quality or actually improving it.
And I believe the commissioner that you mentioned, Tom Fitzgerald, who's also the head of the nonprofit Kentucky Resources Council, has suggested that relaxing these standards would have implications for climate change. What's his concern there?
The argument with climate change, I guess, is that there's something like one coal-fired power plant for every 30 or 40 miles along the Ohio River. You know, they're facing potentially some newer, tougher EPA Clean Water Act standards, which are being held in abeyance from the EPA right now in the Trump administration. But the argument is these power plants, many of them are old, come close to outliving their designed lives, that this could keep them burning coal longer if you relax the rules. And then, of course, that means more carbon dioxide emissions, and which, you know, are linked to climate change.
Jim, I think it was last May, you reported that regional oversight over the river has helped to dramatically improve water quality in the river. And personally, I don't think of the Ohio as a body of water that I would want to swim in or drink from. But 5 million people do, and people do enjoy recreation on the river. Has the quality improved enough to change my perception?
I don't know about that, but I've lived in the area since the end of 1999. So I don't personally recall the Ohio River of the 1960s, but prior to the late 50s, there was no sewage treatment. And so you just had cities that were just treating their streams and creeks and the river itself like open sewers. So that's one issue. And there really wasn't any pollution controls, you know, on industry at that point. So people that I've talked to talk about how, you know, the river smelled like diesel fuel. The fish that you would eat would actually taste like diesel fuel or some kind of chemical. And the studies on terms of numbers and quantities of fish that were in aquatic life that were in the river, they've come back to a certain degree. And so, you know, I think that there were a lot of gains that were made once they put sewage treatment in and then the Clean Water Act came into effect. But there's still this problem with polluted runoff from cities and farms, and there's very little regulation of that. And so it kind of, I think the water quality is sort of, experts tell me it's kind of hit a plateau. It still has residual pollution that's contained in the fish. There's a lot of mercury in the fish. There's other contaminants that are contained in the fish. So there's health advisories and you're not supposed to eat. There's limits on what they recommend that you can eat. But yet it's also as cities like Louisville in particular, and I think Cincinnati and some others, they're opening up their waterfronts, and it's becoming a front door instead of a back door. And they're very popular now for recreation. We have triathlons that are in Ironman competitions here in Louisville that have people swimming in the Ohio River. And there's bass fishing tournaments. So it's become, you know, a recreational place as well as, you know, a drinking water source. And of course, with drinking water utilities, they treat the drinking water. So they become very good at that. But yeah, I definitely think it's better than it was, but it's also still carries a pollution load. And, you know, there's times when you have to be careful if you went swimming in it with a cut in your leg because you might get an infection. And you have to maybe worry about if you were to swallow some water, you might get an infection. I think it's a lot of the sewage issues in particular would have a more immediate on the bacteria, would have more immediate impact on people's health.
So Orsanco, the commission that we mentioned, has so far endorsed a compromise proposal. Where does that stand now? What happens next?
Yeah, I think the earlier proposal, I've been led to believe that that's probably dead. They did not get enough votes to carry that through. They tentatively approved it last summer, and then last fall there was a meeting scheduled where they were going to approve it, and they didn't get enough votes to do that. And so now this compromise has come forward, and Orsanco now has to go through a regular public comment period, public input period. They've got a public hearing in Evansville, Indiana, April 4th. They've got one in Cincinnati, April 8th. And there's actually a webinar they're doing on their website, Orsanco's website, a webinar March 14th. And you can get details by going to their website. And then they'll get that input, and then they have to analyze it and bring it back to their commission and decide kind of what to do next. So the question will be is, does this new proposal, does it give a number of the states also, because I was saying before that it turns out this is something that I think wasn't widely known until Tom Fitzgerald started looking into it as a commissioner, that a number of the states actually aren't following all of the Orsanco standards for various reasons. So the question is will this proposal satisfy the environmental community that wants to continue to have Orsanco have that authority? And will it also satisfy the states that want to be able to have flexibility in how they write their permits? And then, of course, you know, will it satisfy the industries that have been pushing for change?
Do you know how Kentucky ranks in terms of adhering to those standards?
Tom Fitzgerald has told me that they follow some, but not all. And the state has told me that the standards that they have are effectively the same or similar. And they're very detailed. I haven't had an opportunity to kind of go standard by standard to see, you know, exactly what it is. But as of 2015, there was a study that Orsanco did that found that there were 188 instances in which Orsanco had set a standard for a pollutant that neither a member state nor EPA had set a standard for. So they actually had like 188 standards that neither EPA or a state had. And there were some 252 instances in which Orsanco standards were at least 10% more stringent than those of a member state or the EPA. And one of those was arsenic, which, of course, can be found in waste from the burning of coal and is known to cause cancer.
James Bruckers covers the U.S. Southeast for Inside Climate News, and we thank you for joining us, Jim.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, groups in eastern Kentucky who have had enough of the negative publicity and the reasons for it.
But what we're doing, and I think what you'll find when you come to eastern Kentucky these days, is there's a lot of forward thinking going on.
Jerry Roll of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky is joined by Laura Smith of the Appalachian Impact Fund, where entrepreneurialism is getting a lot of attention.
And we see that over and over. People are really systems thinkers in eastern Kentucky, so they're tackling multiple issues and multiple problems with really interesting solutions.
Plus, hemp and maple syrup. Stick with us. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.